Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, we introduced the concept of restoring national sovereignty with the truly national banking system. We went back to William Jennings Bryan, who was the Cowardly Lion of the Wizard of Oz. He proved his courage by challenging the bank's cartel's right to create the national money supply. If you remember, he said in the speech that won him the Democratic nomination in 1896 that I quoted last week, quote, "We believe that the right to coin money and issue money is a function of government. Those who are opposed to this proposition tell us that the issue of paper money is a function of the bank and that the government ought to go out of the banking business. I stand with Jefferson and tell them, as he did, that the issue of money is a function of the government and that banks should go out of the governing business. When we have restored the money of the Constitution, all other necessary reforms will be possible, and until that is done, there is no reform that can be accomplished." Close quote. This is a very powerful, pivotal point in all that I've been discussing for quite a long time in this segment of the show, The Web of Debt. As we see every day in our experience with governmental functioning and the economy, until we have a reform that really restores the money of the Constitution, there really has been no reform that is capable of being accomplished. if we go to the facts, the money of the Constitution was created by the people rather than the banks. Technically, the Constitution gave Congress the exclusive power only to coin money, but the Constitution was drafted in the 18th century when most forms of money in use today either did not exist or were not recognized as money. Thomas Jefferson said that the Constitution needed to be updated to suit the times. A contemporary version of the constitutional provision that Congress shall have the power to coin money would give Congress the exclusive power to create the national currency in all its forms. That would mean either abolishing the Federal Reserve or making it what most people think it is now, a truly federal agency. If the Federal Reserve were an arm of the U.S. government, the dollars it generated could go directly into the U.S. Treasury without the need to add to a crippling federal debt by funding them with bonds. That would take care of 3% of the U.S. money supply. But what about the other 97% that is now created as commercial loans? Would giving Congress the exclusive power to create money mean the government would have to go into the commercial lending business? Perhaps, but why not? As Byron said, banking is the government's business by constitutional mandate. At least, that part of banking is the government's business that involves creating new money. The rest of the lending business could continue to be conducted privately, just as it is now. Banks would just join those non-bank lending institutions that do not create the money they lend, but merely recycle pre-existing funds, including finance companies, pension funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, and securities dealers. Banks would do what most people think they do now: borrow money at a low interest rate and lend it at a higher rate. Returning the power to create money to the government would be more equitable and more constitutional than the current system, but what would it do to bank profits? That was the question raised by officials who reviewed such a proposal in England. The fate of a British proposal for monetary reform is what we'll look at next. The Bank of England was actually nationalized in 1946, but the monetary scheme did not change much as a result. The government took over the function of printing paper money, but in England, as in the United States, printed paper money make up only a very small percentage of the money supply. The bankers still have the power to create money as loans, leaving them in control of the money spigots. In Monetary Reform, Making It Happen, a 2003 publication, James Robertson observed that 97% of Britain's money supply is now created by banks when they advance credit. The result is a grossly unfair windfall to the banks, which get the use of money that is properly an asset of the people. He proposed reforming the system so that it would be illegal for banks to create money as loans, just as it is illegal to forge coins or counterfeit banknotes. Only the central bank could create new money. Commercial banks would have to borrow existing money and relend it, just as non-bank financial institutions do now. In Robertson's proposed system, new money created by the central bank would not go directly to the commercial banks, but would be given to the government to spend into circulation, where it would eventually find its way back to the banks and could be recycled by them as loans. I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to England's plan. When the plan was run past several government officials, however, they maintained that the bank would go broke under such a scheme. Depriving banks of the right to advance credit on the credit multiplier system, which is the British version of a fractional reserve lending system, would increase the cost of borrowing, would raise the cost of payment services, and would force banks to cut costs, close branches and reduce jobs, and would damage the international competitiveness of British banks and therefore of the British economy as a whole. An official with the title of Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer warned that legislating against the credit multiplier would lead to the migration from the City of London of the largest collection of banks in the world. It would be a disaster for the British economy. Another official bearing the title of Treasury Minister argued that if banks were obliged to bid for funds from lenders in order to make loans to their customers, the costs to banks of extending credit would be significant, adversely affecting business investment, especially of small and medium-sized firms. This official wrote in an August 2001 letter, quote, "It is evident that this proposal would cause a dramatic loss in profits to the banks. All else being equal, they would still face the cost of running the payments system, but would not be able to make profitable loans using the deposits held in current accounts. In this case, it is highly likely that banks will attempt to maintain their profitability by relocating to avoid the restriction on their operations that the proposed reform involves." Close quote. And there was the rub. In London, banking was very big business. If the banks were to move en masse to the continent, the British economy could collapse like a house of cards. A proposal similar to the Robertson Plan was presented to the U.S. Congress by Representative Jerry Voorhees in the 1940s. Called the 100% Reserve Solution, it was first devised in 1926 by Professor Frederick Soddy of Oxford and was revived in 1933 by Professor Henry Simmons of the University of Chicago. The plan was to require banks to establish 100% reserve backing for their deposits, something they could do by borrowing enough newly created money from the U.S. Treasury to make up the shortfall. "With this elegant plan," wrote Stephen Zerlenga in The Lost Science of Money, "all the bank credit money the banks have created out of thin air through fractional reserve banking would be transformed into U.S. government legal tender, real honest money." The plan was elegant, but like the Robertson proposal, it would have been quite costly for the banks. It died when Representative Voorhees lost his seat to Richard Nixon in a vicious campaign funded by the bankers. The 100% reserve solution was revived by Robert D. Fremery in a series of articles published in the 1960s. Under his proposal, banks would have two sections, a deposit or checking account section and a savings and loan section. Quote, "The deposit section would merely be a warehouse for money. All demand deposits would be backed dollar for dollar by actual currency in the vaults of the bank. The savings and loan section would sell certificates of deposits, CDs, of varying maturities from 30 days to 20 years, to obtain funds that could be safely loaned for comparable periods of time. Thus, money obtained by the sale of 30-day, 1-year, and 5-year CDs, etc., could be loaned for 30 days, 1 year, and 5 years respectively, not longer. Banks would then be fully liquid at all times and never again need fear a liquidity crisis." Close quote. The liquidity crisis DeFremery was concerned with came from borrowing short and lending long, borrowing short-term deposits and committing them to long-term loans, a common practice that exposes banks to the risk that their depositors will withdraw their money before the loans come due, leaving the banks short of lendable funds. Just such a liquidity crisis materialized in the summer of 2007 when holders of collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, securities backed by income-producing assets, discovered that what they thought were a AAA investments were infected with toxic subprime debt. The value of the CDOs crashed, making banks and other investors either reluctant or unable to lend as before. And that included lending the money market funds relied on by banks to get through a short-term shortage. The other option for banks short of funds is to borrow from the Fed, which can advance accounting entry money as needed, and that is what it has been doing with a vengeance. Recall the $38 billion credit line the Fed made available on a single day in August of 2007? This credit was money created out of thin air, something central banks are considered entitled to do as lenders of last resort. The taxpayer bailouts that used to create politicians to lose votes are being replaced with the hidden tax of a massive stealth inflation of the money supply by the banker's bank, the Federal Reserve, inflating prices and reducing the value of the dollar. DeFremery's 100% reserve solution would have avoided this sort of banking crisis and its highly inflationary solution by limiting banks to lending only money they actually have. The American Monetary Institute, an organization founded by Stephen Zarlenga for furthering monetary reform, has drafted a model American Monetary Act that would achieve this result by imposing a 100% reserve requirement on all checking-type bank accounts. As in DeFremery's proposal, these accounts could not be the basis for loans, but would simply be a warehousing and transferring service for which fees are charged. The Federal Reserve System would be incorporated into the U.S. Treasury, and all new money would be created by these merged government agencies. New money would be spent into circulation by the government to promote the general welfare, monitored in a way so that it was neither inflationary nor deflationary. It would be spent on infrastructure, including education and healthcare, creating jobs, reinvigorating local economies, and refunding government at all levels. Banks would lend in the way most people think they do now, by simply acting as intermediaries that accept savings deposits and lend them out to borrowers. A Model Monetary Reform Act, drafted by Patrick Carmack, co-author with Bill Still of the popular documentary video The Money Masters, would go further. It would impose a 100% reserve requirement on all bank deposits, including savings deposits. Recall that most savings deposits are still transaction accounts in which the money is readily available to the depositor. If it is available to the depositor, it cannot have been lent to someone else without duplicating the funds. Under Carmack's proposal, banks that serviced depositors could not lend at all unless they were using their own money. If banks wanted to make loans of other people's money, they would have to set up separate institutions for that purpose, not called banks, which could lend only pre-existing funds. Banks making loans would join those other lending institutions that can lend only when they first have the money in hand. Deposits would not be counted as reserves against which loans could be made, but would be held in trust for the exclusive use of the depositor. So this brings up the issue of how to eliminate fractional reserve banking without eliminating the banks. And I'll come back to that in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. If the power to create the national money supply is going to be the exclusive domain of Congress, 100% banking will have to be required for any private bank deposits that can be withdrawn on demand. But proposals for requiring 100% reserves have met with the objection that they could bankrupt the banks. The problem can be seen in the case of Japan, which by 1985 had emerged as the world's largest creditor. In 1988, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland came out with the Basel Accord, raising bank capital requirements a mere 2% from 6% to 8%. The result was to destroy Japan's financial system, which had to be nationalized. We've seen that when a bank makes a loan, it merely writes a deposit into the borrower's account, treating the deposit as a liability of the bank. This is money the bank owes to the borrower in return for the borrower's promise to pay it back. Under a 100% reserve system, all of these bank liabilities would have to be funded with real money. Federal Reserve Statistical Release H.8 put the total loans and leases and bank credit of all U.S. banks as of April of 2007 at $6 trillion. Since banks today operate with minimal reserves, 10% or even less, they might have to borrow 90% of $6 trillion in real money to meet a 100% reserve requirement. To find the money to service these loans, they would have to raise interest rates and reduce the interest they paid to depositors, shrinking their profit margins and squeezing their customers. Just the rumor of increased reserve requirements could set bank stocks tumbling. William Hummel is not actually in the money reform camp, but in December of 2006, in a critique of the 100% reserve solution, he raised some interesting issues and alternatives. Rather than borrowing from the government, he suggested that the banks could sell their existing loans to investors, getting the loans off their books. This is not actually a new idea, but is something banks have been doing for a number of years. In 2007, securitized mortgage debts, mortgages sliced into mortgage-backed securities, were reported at $6.5 trillion, or about one-half of all outstanding mortgage debt, totaling $13 trillion. Securitized debt is debt that has been offloaded by selling it to investors who collect the interest as it comes due. In effect, the banks have merely acted as middlemen, bringing investors with funds together with borrowers who needed funding. This is the role of investment banks, putting together deals, finding investors for projects in need of funds. It is also the role played by bank intermediaries in Islamic banking. The bank sets up profit-sharing arrangements in which investors buy stock rather than interest-bearing bonds. Where could enough investors be found to fund close to $6 trillion in outstanding bank loans? Recall the nearly $9 trillion in bond money that would be freed up if the federal debt were paid off by monetizing it with new greenback dollars. People who had previously stored their savings in government bonds would be looking for a steady source of income to replace the interest stream they had just lost. Investment fund managers, quick to see an opportunity, would no doubt form funds just for this purpose. They could buy up the bank's existing loans with money from their investors and bundle them into securities. The investors then would be paid interest as it accrued on the loans. In this way, the same greenback dollars that had monetized the federal debt could be used to monetize the $6 trillion in bank loans created with accounting entries by the banks. Investors today have become leery of buying securitized debt, but this is due largely to lax disclosure and regulation. If the securities laws were strengthened so that all risks were known and on the table, at some price, investors could no doubt be found. And if they couldn't, the banks could still turn to the Fed for an advance of funds, which is just what they have been doing, accepting a lifeline from the Fed in the form of massive bailouts with highly inflationary accounting entry money. The difference under a 100% reserve system would be that the Federal Reserve would actually be federal, operating its bailouts in a way that benefited the people rather than just inflating their dollars away. The challenge is the truth. The banking system is already bankrupt. To the charge that imposing a 100% reserve requirement could bankrupt the banks, the wizard's retort might have been that the banking system is already bankrupt. The 300-year fractional reserve Ponzi scheme has reached its mathematical endpoint. The bankers' chickens have come home to roost, and only a radical overhaul will save the system. Nouriel Roubini, professor of economics at New York University and a former advisor to the U.S. Treasury, gave this bleak assessment in a November 2007 newsletter. Quote, "I now see the risk of a severe and worsening liquidity and credit crunch leading to a generalized meltdown of the financial system of a severity and magnitude like we have never observed before. In this extreme scenario, whose likelihood is increasing, we could see a generalized run on some banks and runs on a couple of weaker non-bank broker deals that may go bankrupt with severe and systemic ripple effects on a mass of highly leveraged derivative instruments that will lead to a seizure of the derivatives markets, massive losses on money market funds, ever-growing defaults and losses, $500 billion-plus dollars in subprime, near-prime, and prime mortgages, severe problems and losses in commercial real estate, the drying up of liquidity and credit in a variety of asset-backed securities, putting the entire model of securitization at risk, runs on hedge funds and other financial institutions that do not have access to the Fed's lender of last resort support, and a sharp increase in corporate defaults and credit spreads." Close quote. We are reaching the point at which the private banking system can no longer be saved with a stream of accounting entry reserves to support an expanding pyramid of fractional reserve lending. The banks may need either to be nationalized, as they were in Japan, or to take up some other line of work. Chris Cook is a British market consultant who was formerly director of the International Petroleum Exchange. He observes that the true role of banks is to serve as guarantors and facilitators of deals. The seller wants his money now, but the buyer doesn't have it. He wants to pay over time. So the bank steps in and advances credit by creating a deposit from which the borrower can pay the seller. The bank then collects the buyer's payments over time, adding interest as its compensation for assuming the risk that the buyer won't pay. But the interests of creditor and debtor are opposed. The creditor actually makes more money when the debtor is financially strapped by keeping the debtor on the hook and increasing finance charges. A more congenial model is investment banking or Islamic banking, bringing investors together with projects in need of funds. The money already exists. The bank just arranges the deal and the issuance of stock. It is a joint venture rather than a creditor-debtor relationship. The investor makes money only if the company makes money, and the company makes money only if it produced goods and services that add value to the economy. The parasite becomes a partner, and there is no drain from profits in the form of interest without productivity to support it. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.